You're free now. Free to stream beyond your wildest dreams. Free to be everything you imagine, and then some. That's how it feels to have Quantum Fiber. Your world unleashed. Learn more at quantumfiber.com. Limited availability. Service in select locations only.
Do you love the Tabernacle Choir? This year, the choir's music is everywhere you are. Listen to your favorite choir songs and music and the spoken word anytime you want on Alexa by simply enabling the skill.
Alexa, play the Tabernacle Choir.
Now playing the Tabernacle Choir.
You can also download the Tabernacle Choir app, subscribe to the choir on YouTube, listen on Spotify, and have access to all their wonderful music. Happy listening.
Radio check. Loud and clear.
KSL Sports and KSL Podcast present Mode Push, an American view of F1, starting now.
And I'm stuck. He's Ricky Cut with his Odyssey.
I'm gutted. I'm absolutely gutted.
I enjoyed this so much. Thank you.
All right, everybody, welcome on in. It's another edition right here of Mode Push, an American view of F1. It's our F1 podcast. And I just want to say, too, it's not just the American view, because we have a lot of listeners that are outside of the United States now at this point. So we want to say thank you for downloading the podcast wherever you're found. Now, you might be Americans abroad. Either way, we'll take it. And this is not an American-specific only podcast, Dan Jimenez, my co-host of the program, right? I mean, we'll take all comers here at this point. We're desperate.
Oh, we're Big Tent, for sure.
We are Big Tent. We do not kick anybody out. I do want to mention, though, at the very top here, if you're listening to the program and maybe you've been recommended to listen to the podcast, we say thank you. We say thanks on behalf of KSL Sports and KSL Podcast and Dan and myself. I'm going to do a couple of different things here. So I want you to go and just do us a quick favor. This is now our 34th episode, just in the last now less than a year and a half that we've been doing this thing. So we're pretty committed to doing this thing every week during the race season and even more during the actual like race weeks. And so this is not a plea for money at all. this is not like, and it's our week at NPR here where we're asking you for extra dollars. Now, just go in and take a moment and just rate the podcast or tell somebody about it. We would love to get a couple of reviews in there as well. We have a handful from folks that we love. And so we would appreciate just taking a couple moments, go in and rate the podcast on the platform of choice that you listen to and write a comment as well. Give us some feedback. I'm going to give my email address out. And Dan, I'm putting you on the spot here. Maybe you want to do the same or not, but my email is just alexkiry@gmail.com. It's alexkiry@gmail.com. And if you have any questions for either Dan or I, if it's engineering based, that's going to be a great question for Dan, but I can also get him those questions as well. So I want to start fielding questions, Dan, from other people who are listening outside of this thing. I want to start getting some reviews and some things going on this because we want to make this big over time here. We have day jobs, so we don't need to ask you for your we don't need to subscribe. We don't need you to subscribe to anything for money. All we need you to do is just have fun listening to the podcast and then rate and review it and give us some suggestions and also throw us a question or two that's F1 based or race based at all. I mean, frankly, Dan knows a lot more than just about F1, but of course we talk F1 mostly on this podcast. So Dan, there's my email. Do you have the guts to give your email address out?
Man, this just shows you how old you and I are, because mine's just like yours. It's just my first name, last name at Gmail. Man. So Dan Jimenez@gmail.com. And it just goes to show that we were really old and we got emails when Google was brand new.
Remember when I remember getting that invite and I was like, hey man, now I had a double whammy that I was able to not just get the invite. I also have a weird enough name. Dan Jimenez means you actually were on the ground floor, but I remember exactly where I was. I was in college and it was like probably 2004, maybe.
That's what I was. Mine was 2004, freshman year. I remember in the dorms. Shout out to Gary Lind, wherever you are, for giving me that
That's
invite.
Exactly right. And I don't know who gave me the invite, but I remember getting it and being like, well, this sounds a lot better than Hot Chick 41 at Hotmail. I just hated the term Hotmail. It just sounded awful. My parents were like, what are you into? And I was like, geez.
This is not salacious.
All right, so let's get going on the podcast here. Let's do a little bit of some news things. Dan also has a breakdown today of Red Bull's success and what it is equaling currently at this point. Really, what the biggest things that have happened with their racing performance, aero stuff. I get very bogged down, and when people start talking about low speed, high speed, medium speed corners, and kind of, you know, they're like, oh, this sets up well for this team or whatever. But Red Bull doesn't seem to be behind on anything at this point. So Dan's going to break down a couple of things that they've been doing and how some of the words that I've heard this week, or at least some of the accusations, Dan, from I think it was George Russell who threw it out there, that he was just like, oh, yeah, these guys are actually beating the heck out of everybody and they're holding back. Like, there's actual stuff. Like, they do not want to get called out by F1. This is all according to George Russell. They don't want to get called out by F1, so they're not showing you everything because it'd be too big of a disparity, and then they'd start getting looked at more closely, and they don't want any of that noise. So the weirdest flex of like, oh, you're too afraid to show how fast you really are so you don't get busted, while the rest of us just watch Red Bull beat everybody. So Dan will have that explanation. I do want to roll this one out and ask you. I thought Honda wanted out of F1.
Right, yeah.
I thought the Honda power unit thing was like, hey, man, this has been a great run. We're all about going green now. We don't want to get into the racing thing. We want to focus all on our cars and our factories and blah, blah, blah. What on earth is Honda now flirting with Aston Martin, whose current power unit provider is Mercedes, obviously. But how is it that Honda suddenly jumped back into the game, or at least started to come back in there? Is this more giving us an indication that their relationship with Red Bull may have soured a little bit more? Or what are we getting from this?
Really good question. I feel like Honda changes their mind more than a moody teenager. Like, I think we're all just over their flakiness on, are you going to be in the sport or are you not going to be in the sport? And I think that your theory sounds the best to me. It's that it might have been more just directly about, like, working with Red Bull is a pain in the butt. And so they got out of that relationship. And Aston Martin, they've got money. They're looking to make a splash. Lawrence Stroll wants a championship. So if they are going to stay in the sport, I think that is a logical team to go with. And I think that Lawrence Stroll would probably also want to get out of underneath the shadow of being like the Mercedes B team too. So I think this is kind of maybe them trying to stake their flag in the ground as more of an independent top tier team with their own engine manufacturer. But I don't understand the logic from Honda. Are you going to be in? Are you going to be out? Like, it's clear that it's a popular sport with rising popularity.
That's why it was weird when they got out in the first place. You're like, what are you guys doing? You're winning races, and then you're doing this, like, riding off into the sunset thing. I don't know what's going on here. And then they were still providing, like, a lot of the parts that are sitting on Max Verstappen's soon-to-be championship-winning car this year, you know, still have Honda blood in them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they might have a different badge on them because power – Red Bull Power or whatever makes these engines now. But I mean, like, without the development of Honda, you're not able to make that transition to what that is. I just thought it was an interesting thing this week. And here's the other thing. Mm-hmm. If you're Aston Martin, why on earth do you want to walk away from the engine that's been given you the best shot in I don't know how long for this team, and walking away from that relationship? Unless Mercedes is the one that says, nah, you guys are beating the heck out of us and we're the worst team. Like, get out of here.
Yeah, that is definitely a risk. I think that they're hoping just for a new era, that in 2026 that they're winning races, and that Honda comes with lots of experience and, you know, championship experience as well. So it's not like a brand new engine manufacturer that would be, I think, a lot more risky. I think that it's probably a pretty safe bet going with Honda and all the years that they've had in the sport.
Did you throw your hat in the ring to apply for an Audi F1 job in the last week, Dan? Because they started hiring this last week. They're going to hire 300 people by the end of the year to already get their stuff going and get everything developing by the time they can get this Audi Sauber, whomever car, onto the track in 2026. Is that what it is?
Right, 2026.
So they're hiring everybody out, and so they're going to have 300 new employees there. Now, the funniest part about this, and again, salacious rumors that I have no problem spreading. Carlos Sainz, I read this article about how he soured a little bit of what's going on in Maranello, which I don't think Ferrari sours on people. I think what happens is you can. I think it's a lot of pressure that one isn't deserved because the team's not good enough right now to have that pressure. It's like, why am I getting murdered in the freaking Italian media that is awful and dealing with this and not having a great car? You know, it's a bummer because this guy's one of the better racers on the grid. But the rumor is that he would be somebody who may be interested in that first Audi drive in 2026. That would mean, of course, he would have to walk away from Ferrari. But I don't know. Does somebody actively walk away from Ferrari and go to a brand new team? Would that be totally unprecedented? I would imagine with all of the ups and downs in F1 that it's not totally out of the realm of historically what has happened. But still, this is the place that Carlos Sainz, you know, certainly Charles Leclerc, like this is the team that they have always wanted to be on for their entire lives. And here they are. And there's a little bit of grumpiness there at the very least.
Yeah, I wouldn't blame them if they left. That's for sure. Especially if the rest of the season goes like how it's already gone. I would start thinking, you know, in 2024, how do I position myself for any open seat at a top tier team? Because it's the opportunities don't come around all that often to get a seat in a you know, a top tier team. Now, it's very early to be able to say that Audi is a top tier team. They're going to be, you know, a manufactured team, so they'll I think not be in, you know, a slouch, but I think that could be exciting. For Ferrari to lose drivers voluntarily, like wanting to leave, that is a big black mark on that brand. But I mean, they just got to get their act together to want to be the place that drivers want to go. I think they'll always be, you know, attractive to up and coming talent that wants to make a name for themselves. And so, you know, thinking about the midfield, like Lando Norris, you know, should he go to Ferrari? Could he be a replacement for Carlos Sainz? Probably. Like that might line up well with his contracts. So yeah, I think it's very interesting. Hopefully they can get some, you know, local homeboy blood there too, with maybe a German driving one of the Audis.
Let me ask you this though, because I don't even know. Can you buy Audi gear already? I mean, I'm like on board. Hold on a minute. I'm doing a search while we're doing this. Audi
F1 gear.
F1 gear. I want merch, man. You know, I drive an Audi. I'm all about. I'll pretend like I've been on this since day one. So I'm like, look, yes, you can get Audi gear.
Wow.
Audi Sport
Good
is
for
a
them.
Thing,
They're
man.
On it.
They will absolutely sell you some Audi F1 stuff. Now, I haven't been able to afford Audi F1 gear or any F1 gear, it seems like, in the last little bit. But these seem to be on the cheap because it definitely does not seem licensed at all by anybody. This looks like the stuff that you'd get in, you know, when you're hanging out in South America and you go, oh, that looks like a great price on that. And it definitely is not this. Oh, they only have three rings on Audi on this one. Yeah, there's there's some of that in there. Okay. Well, let me see here. So with Carlos Sainz and the possibility of that, I don't know. Speaking of Carlos Sainz, he did make a statement. He says that now, tell me if this is wrong. F1 gave him the FU by telling him that they're not even going to look at it. Like, they're not even going to look at the penalty that they were going to review. He said 2 weeks later, I think the penalty is too disproportionate, and I believe it should have at least been reviewed. F1 said, we're not even going to review this thing. Yeah, we're denying you the right to review. So he walks away from that thing. The further you can – I think the more you talk about this, if you're Carlos Sainz, it just looks like sour grapes, and it just seems like a waste of time. But it is not – it just is all these things piling up for a guy who probably going into the season thought, I'm going to be top three in the world championship race this year.
I think that if you're Carlos Sainz, you have to be above it all at this point. You appealed. They didn't accept it. You move on. To your point, he's starting to look like the Warriors, like complaining about Sabonis swinging the ball too hard. It's like, come on, man, just like your Ferrari, just move on, you know, and act like champions. I think that if you're at Formula One, these reviews, like, it's like anybody, everybody can appeal almost anything, right? So you have to be selective in what you're willing to review. And because I think if they allow a review for everything, then everyone is just going to like want to complain, and it's going to create a lot of process. Right. And then it's so hard to rule, I think, with, you know, consistently, because we've talked about how, you know, the rule book is super thick, but then in the end, it's left up a lot to the race steward's judgment in the moment. So I'm not totally like mad that, you know, for Formula One decided to say, you know, this one, we stick by the call as it was made, and, you know, let's move on to the next game.
It's sort of, you know, this happens in, I've learned a lot about the officiating in a lot of these sports, you know, since it's just kind of my job to talk about sports. And so in Major League Baseball, they absolutely train their umpires to not do, basically, if somebody argues, they can't even bring it up. Like, they know that they're wrong on stuff. They'll know that they'll be wrong on things. And if a guy gets thrown out of the game, you can't reverse that, for example. So if a guy gets thrown out of a game, so somebody got thrown out the other day, and it was like a really questionable thing. Like, no, it was a misunderstanding. The guy definitely should not have been thrown out. It was a catcher who had been thrown out for something really asinine, and the, you know, the manager comes out, but the guy had tossed him, and then you can't go back on it, and that's the rule. And it was like, and then it was like, and I can't talk about why I threw him out even with you anymore. And so they have this conversation. Yeah. Then it's just them bickering one against the other, and their whole thing is like, well, listen, we're going to get bogged down way too much in semantics on the field. That it's one thing to be reviewing it during a race too, which sometimes they also do. Obviously, stewards have to make kind of in-race decisions as well. But it's one thing to be like, hey, man, I'm not going to talk about this right now because we have a baseball game going on. I'm not going to talk about this right now. We have a race week coming up, and we can't have every little conversation with everybody about why we chose this. And the line between racing incident and you know, your fault and it's going to cost you 5 seconds, you know, sometimes I'm still unclear on that, but that one didn't seem nearly as close as he's probably creating it to be. So in that sense, Carlos Sainz wins the award this week of being the biggest baby. And you know, knocking off our current and almost usual champion, George Russell, in the complaining that he does, and right along his teammate, Lewis Hamilton. So let's get into a little bit of, those are just some of the breaking news things here. But last week we were talking about how you wanted to dive in on how Red Bull has become so dominant this year. And people who are joining F1 for the first time in the last few years, Mercedes was dominant and won 7 consecutive constructors titles. And that was insane. And in race in and race out, as a new F1 person, as a new F1 fan myself, I remember thinking, this is a sport problem because you don't want to have somebody so dominant. It's one thing to have a dynasty, but dominance is not dynasty necessarily. And dynasties imply that they don't happen very often, you know, as it is. But we've gone from Mercedes, who was super dominant, to now Red Bull, who's in their second, probably in a row, constructors title and third racers title in the last 3 years. And it's even more despairing. I think the gap is even bigger for Red Bull in comparison to the other teams and their performance. Where is that performance coming from, Dan?
Yeah, the it's so hard to know for sure, right? Because obviously Red Bull's not going to just open up their playbook to everybody. And so the way to find out or in kind of pick up on the clues and the hints of what another team is doing is kind of limited to what you can see on the exterior and the of the car, as well as what can you see in the data, right? And so then it just becomes like this kind of challenge of like, who's the best investigative engineer into looking at all the data and, you know, the photography that all these teams get after each race weekend. They'll come back and they'll have, you know, hundreds of gigabytes of photos taken from people in the paddock that are hired by the teams to take close-up shots and then try to figure out, okay, what, you know, what's Red Bull trying to do. So two things.
That's some Bill Belichick level stuff. But it like totally. Is par for the course in this sport, though, right? I'm coming to find out.
Yeah, it's just that's just what you have to do. So a couple of things that I've been reading up on that Red Bull is kind of either doing uniquely or is really standing out in the data. So maybe we'll do the data one first. And it's really cool that F1 publishes a lot of this telemetry from the cars because the, you know, super fans can dig into it and start to find interesting trends and insights to share with the rest of us that a lot of other motorsports series don't do. But the first one is, and shout out to the F1 Data Analysis Twitter account for both
be,
of these.
That would be one of your follows, wouldn't it?
Oh, it's a great follow. So shout out to that guy. But the first one is DRS effectiveness. So the DRS, we all know, is the drag reduction system that during certain points of the track of the lap, the car lifts an element of the rear wing so that it can gain a speed advantage down the straight relative to the car in front of it. If it's within a second, they can use their DRS. And so the DRS effectiveness is really like how much extra performance does a team eke out of their car when their DRS is mm-hmm. open versus when it's closed. And a more effective DRS will look on the track like, oh my gosh, like Max is able to pass people so easily on the straights when he's in DRS. And I think we saw that as he was coming up through the field in the last couple of races.
And is that just is that just a pure speed thing then too? Like, is it just pure speed that you gain from that? Or is it also, you know, I guess maybe the lack of what else are you gaining from that? Or maybe is it a little bit more downforce, or what else is that wing being yeah. open do?
It's all about just straight line speed. As soon as the drivers hit the brakes, then that automatically disengages the DRS and that element drops back down on the rear wing. And, you know, now it's like in high downforce mode. So when it's the DRS is open and it's in low drag mode, then it's all just about hitting a higher top speed before you get to the corner. And so we've seen it with Max that he's able to just, when he's under DRS, his speed differential relative to the car in front of him is just so much. So looking at the data, the amount of like drag reduction that we can predict based off of like the data by team is it's really interesting. So here's the range. So Aston Martin comes in with the lowest DRS effectiveness at 23.6%. So you could think of that as they have 23% less drag when their DRS is open than when it's closed. Mm. And then you go through the list, Aston Martin, then Alpine, Mercedes, McLaren, Williams, AlphaTauri, Ferrari, Alfa Romeo, Haas, and then Red Bull as the most effective at 37.5%.
Wow,
so geez. Aston Martin was 23.6, Red Bull 37.5.
When you hear that, you're like, how is Aston Martin even competing? But maybe their straight line speed prior to even having their DRS open, maybe it's a little bit more than some of these other teams who have better effectiveness by percentage, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So what it shows to me is that, you know, Red Bull is, they have a very aggressive rear wing in terms of how much downforce it's creating, and then therefore translating probably into a lot of drag. Hmm. And so they're probably just banking on, hey, we're going to be out in clear air because we'll qualify up front, and then we're going to be able to, you know, run around in clean air, manage our tires. And if we ever get put back into the pack, then we'll gain a lot of that speed back by just, you know, how we design our DRS, because you can design the car for how does the air flow around it when the DRS is closed, as well as for how does the air flow around it when the DRS is open. And so they might have a design that's more optimized for low drag when the DRS is open. So there's it's just a bit of an interesting data point to see. And it kind of definitely jives with how, you know, we see the racing playing out when the Red Bulls get back in the pack, that they're able to just kind of pick up spots really quickly because of how low drag their car is when the DRS is open.
You know,
that's item number one.
I was thinking about this in terms of like an American sport thing where, because all the drivers and all the team principals and anybody associated with these other teams. And I don't know if it's more of a sandbagging thing. Like you just don't want to, it's okay. Like you don't want to talk about how your performance is so bad. Maybe it's easier to just talk about how awesome Red Bull is and they're beating everybody and they're the class of, because at any point in any other sport that I seem to follow, it's like, you are never going to, there's parity, you know? And I hate that word actually for sports, but they're like, you know, the ability to be from one team to the next, to have it be close. I mean, right now, with the amount of points that Red Bull has scored versus second-place Aston Martin, they've doubled them up almost. And then, you know, it's not even close. Not even close, and it's not going to be close. And the reliability that Red Bull has is pretty darn good this year compared to what it was last year at this time. And so when you see just even giant disparities like that, okay, so you have this one thing, And the Aero stuff is what Adrian Newey, who is like the godfather of Aero, I feel like, right? I mean, like he's Red Bull's, you know, back pocket, like secret weapon, right? Isn't that kind of how they're looking at this guy right now?
Yeah. Yeah. And he's been around the sport forever. And yeah, he is. He was part of the kind of the whole cost cap controversy because he's technically a consultant and not like a Red Bull employee. So somehow his salary isn't included in the cost cap, which I just don't understand how that works. But yeah, he's like the godfather of Formula One car development and aero for the last 20 years.
So item two, we've seen the DRS and the DRS is all standard for everybody, right? Like, and is the driver, enables it, right? Don't they activate it? Okay.
And then the brake is automatic
when it turns it off.
Correct. Yep. The driver activates it. And sometimes you get issues where the DRS doesn't open when it should. And I think we've seen that in some races in the past few years. And that can be really annoying as a driver. But yeah, so that's item number one. Item number two. Okay, I'm going to try and do this. It's going to be a nerdy topic.
Here we go, Egghead.
But I'm going to do the best I can to help the listener at home visualize what we're talking about here. But when we think about aero, you know, the amount of downforce that a car creates changes throughout the lap based on like the attitude of the car. Like, how is it pitched? Is it rolled? Is it yawed out? Like in the corners, like basically how the car moves on the track will affect your aerodynamic performance as well as the balance. You know, as a bunch of the aero load on the front, is it on the back? And that really dictates how the car performs. So we can control that based on how you set up the car with its suspension and its springs and its basic kind of suspension design. And ideally, you would like to have the car be at like the optimal angle of attack for aerodynamic performance the entire way around the track. But that would require like really stiff suspension that would be bad and like, you know, if you hit a bump or if you're in slow corners. And so it's always a trade-off. Now, there's been a lot of smoke and rumor in the last couple of weeks of people accusing, well, Red Bull's running an active suspension. And an active suspension is, and you know, we have now in our modern day cars and sports cars or even like off-road, you know, trucks and stuff. But an active suspension is basically a fluid inside of the dampers, the shocks, that can change its viscosity. And so that if it's going fast or going slow, it can behave differently and optimize the performance of the suspension based on kind of what the car is doing. Now, that's illegal in F1. There are no active suspensions. And I think anybody who is accusing Red Bull is like of having an active suspension is like, I don't know. I don't think anybody in the paddock is really making that accusation because that's like pretty dramatic to accuse that. But there are ways to get the same type of response out of the suspension that are a bit simpler. And one of those is called anti-dive. And if you think about when you're driving a car and you hit the brakes, like the nose dips, right? You kind of dive onto the front and all the weight goes onto the front of the tires. And you can think about like the aero as well will move to the front. It's called the center of pressure, will move to the front of the car. And then when you get on the gas and the car heaves backwards, then it all kind of does the opposite. And so anti-dive is like a force that you can generate in the car based on the design of your suspension arms. So these wheels, they're attached to the cars with, you know, two primary like wishbones. They're kind of in the shape of a triangle with the pointy ends attached to like the spindle or the wheel, and then the base of the triangle attached to the car. Mm-hmm. And those wishbones, there's an upper and a lower one, and how you mount those to the car and like the angle that they make, if you're looking at the car from the side view, the angle that they make and how they're the kind of the attitude of those wishbones creates a geometry that determines the anti-dive. Like, and you have this center of gravity of the, or center of mass of the car, which is kind of like the driver's back, you know, that's pretty much where the center of mass is. And so depending on how you set the design and how much anti-dive you build into the car, what you can actually do is that when you hit the brakes, the forces that are generated in the front suspension act like it's a almost like you've got a really stiff front suspension, and it keeps the nose from diving. That's why it's called anti-dive. It keeps the car at like a consistent angle. And then you can do the same for the reverse as well. So what Red Bull seems to be doing based on observations and photos and everything is that they have a very aggressive front suspension anti-dive, and the anti-dive allows them to run the car lower the entire lap without necessarily having to have really stiff front springs. So they can have the same like soft front springs, but when they get into the corner and Max puts on the brake, the geometry of the front suspension acts like a stiff spring just with the way that it's configured, and they keep the attitude of the car where it needs to be, so it doesn't like bottom out or hit the nose or something like that. And so Red Bull can run the car really low the entire race or the entire way around the lap and kind of gain a bit of an advantage. Now, why isn't everybody doing this? It's if it's obvious that they're doing something different, everybody could try it. It has lots of other trade-offs that you have to make with how the car acts, but one of them is like feel. Like it changes the way that the car feels and drives. And so you would have to have drivers that have gotten really used to driving a car with lots of anti-dive that could know how to still get the performance out of the car. So they would have to drive the corners a little bit differently, but in the end, it's a net benefit if they're able to handle the car. So I think it would be, you know, kind of kudos to Max and Sergio if they've figured out how to drive a car that might not drive how they're, you know, normally used to the car driving, all for the sake of gaining a bit of an aero advantage. So you that's reason number two.
It was actually appropriate this week that you brought up the active suspension stuff, because active suspension was, like so many other things in motor racing, became something that was born in F1 and then lived and then started to live in real cars that they put in production that, you know, like we drive today. And it was a Williams team invention. It was a Frank Williams team invention in the early 90s. And when they, and it was part of the regulations because they wouldn't have, you know, said, hey, you can't have an active suspension because it was never something that was ever invented. So they actually did this. They invented this pneumatic, you know, active suspension, and they won by a freaking landslide the 1993 constructors title with Alan Prost winning the championship that year. And I think that there were races that they were up 2.5 seconds per lap on teams.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, that's just the difference that a piece of technology like that made. And then, at some point they were like, hey, listen, what's going on here? And they had to share. And then at some point they took it away and they said, hey, awesome piece of technology. We'll put it on real cars in the real world, but let's do like real racing cars for now. So the Williams in 1993 was the first active suspension. It was invented by an F1 team, and they crushed everybody. So if there's some version of that and we're seeing Red Bull crushing everybody, it seems that it would make sense. Although now the regulations are so tightly, guarded, tightly, you know, implemented.
Yeah.
And even though there's some differential between the cars and some of the things that they do aero-wise, overall, there are things you cannot mess with on a car, and that's kind of one of them.
Yeah, that's one that would be very hard to hide what they're doing. Anybody who looked at the car without like the front cover on it would quickly see it. So, yeah. So I guess if you're at home or driving in your car and you have a button that lets you push sport mode and it changes how the ride of your car feels, thank Frank Williams for that.
Yeah. Thank Sir Frank Williams for and his team for that. I think there was, you know, some, as always, there's usually some brainiac engineer who actually develops it, and then Frank Williams, of course, put his name on it because it was his team. Anyway, okay, what else you got?
That's it. Those are the two main, observations so far, as you know, suspension design that keeps the car at like seemingly the perfect attitude or angle of attack for performance, aero performance, and then the DRS is super effective. So when they get back in the pack, they can, you know, just zip their way up back to the front really quickly.
It seems interesting too, because at the same time, you know, racing drivers like their car to behave a certain way more than, you know, I think that they were saying that in Max Verstappen's case, he likes a little bit of understeer. And some people like oversteer, and I'm like, I don't know why you would like either of those things. Like, but for some reason, I guess I can deal with it a little bit better. What does that mean when somebody says, yeah, oh, yeah, he loves to have his car a little bit more aggressive, and he likes to be able to, he likes a little bit more understeer.
Yeah, understeer is when you go into the corner and you turn the wheel, and it pushes out to the outside of the corner, and you end up like, it's like one way to say it is like, understeer is when you go through a corner and you hit the wall with the front of the car, and oversteer is when you go through the corner and you hit the wall at the back of the car. So oversteer is like if you've ever like lost it around a corner driving in the snow and you got a counter, you know, steer right into the corner, mm-hmm, that's oversteer. And then understeer is like, oh, I, you know, cooked it way too hard in this corner and now my front tires are screeching. So why would a driver want one more than the other? It's all about confidence and predictability and what the car is going to do. So with understeer, you know, Max can be more aggressive on the entry of the corner, because he, you know, knows the car isn't going to pitch out, like kind of turn out on him, where a driver who likes oversteer can be more aggressive in the mid corner and coming off the corner. So they'll have a better kind of mid to corner exit, because the car will rotate into the corner more easily. And so, man, it's something in NASCAR that we fought all the time. It was like the drivers would always say, oh, it's oversteering into the corner, and then it's understeering in the middle, and then it's oversteering on the way out. It's like every driver complains about that. And it's like, well, that's just like the physics of the car. Sorry, man. Like, that's what it's like. I can't really change that. Sure. And so they have to, drivers have to change their styles if they want it. Ultimately what you want to do is use all four tires as effectively as possible, like right at their limits. So if a driver is really oversteering a lot, they're just going to burn through their front tires really quickly. And then they'll be really slow in the corners. And then if somebody oversteers a bunch, they're going to burn up their rear tires, and then they're not going to be able to get up out of the corner as quick as other folks. So it's all part of the tire management game.
If somebody asks though, and they go, oh, so why is Red Bull so fast? Because I heard they're pretty dominant. You just go, either listen to this episode of Mode Push, or you just go, hey, look, Red Bull is smarter than everybody currently. Like, that's kind of the end of it. It's just like they have stuff figured out right now. And – you know, because you're so dominant, people mistake it for cheating, right? I mean, they just go, oh, yeah, this is cheating. Do you think would you be shocked if there was some little thing that they were kind of, you know, doing, I guess, and pushing that envelope when it comes to the cheating? If you're not cheating, you're not trying. I guess what was the saying in NASCAR, you know, rubbing is racing?
Yeah.
In F1, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. So there you go.
Exactly, yeah. All these teams are doing something that they would like F1 to not know about, right? So no, I would not be surprised. But I'm sure it's pretty minor performance gains. I mean, to George Russell's point, as much as it bugs me, like to George Russell's point, like Red Bull wouldn't want to be, two and a half seconds faster than everybody else, because then F1 will just like confiscate their car and like tear through it. So you just want to be just fast enough relative to the competition. But I doubt that they would be able to do anything that was, I mean, they all add up, right? It's like, who can find those performance gains in enough quantity of like small wins to all add up to be in the fastest car. So it's a game of always chasing the fastest car and figuring out what they're doing that you're not.
All right, here's what we're gonna do next week. Dan, that was beautiful. That was as nerdy of an explanation as you've ever done on the show. And it's the main reason why we keep you coming back, because this is somebody always knows more than we do. You're the Adrian Newey of our podcast. So we'll somehow have to figure out how to hide your salary in the without using the cost cap. This week coming up, there is actually a race. Thank heavens, right? So by the time you download this and listen to it, we're already going to be planning a race preview for Baku. And with that, I also have – I was thinking about doing it this week, but we ran out of time. But I've got it for next week. All of the things that these drivers do in the off season or in the downtime, and certainly they had a little bit of it extra here. Maybe you saw pictures of it, but what these racers like to do on the grid to relax and do as their other hobbies. Dan, did you have fun this week?
Yeah. Oh, man. This is my bread and butter. I love this stuff. I just hope I didn't put anybody to sleep.
It's awesome.
We'll have to pace ourselves with how often we get nerdy.
All right. Review it, rate it, subscribe, send us emails, however you want. Mode Push is going to be here for you. So for Dan, I'm Alex. We'll talk to you next week, everybody. Happy racing.
It's finally time to say goodbye to the snow and hello to spring, and right now is the best time to spring into adventure in an RV from a Motorsportsland RV Center. Through this week, come check out Motorsportsland's season kickoff event and find the RV you've been dreaming of. Save thousands and even tens of thousands off MSRP and find your next adventure at a Motorsportsland RV Center today.
Let Motorsportsland help you get away.
Motorsportsland.com.
Hey, Casey Scott here, and I want to tell you about my podcast, Project Recovery, sponsored by Reprieve Recovery. It's a podcast about addiction, but more importantly, it's about recovery. My co-host, Dr. Matt Woolley, and I hear stories about overcoming addiction and going from rock bottom to living a healthier and sober lifestyle.
We also share strategies with people at all stages of recovery, and we hope it'll help you find what works best for you, and we can support one another. That's Project Recovery, a KSL podcast. Subscribe for free anywhere you listen to podcasts.